This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor at Slate, online at slate.com, and the legal correspondent for National Public Radio. She joins us live in studio here on Rose Hill Drive. I talked to you last week about coming in because you wrote an article recently for Slate titled Sudden Death. The slug was American support for the death penalty is diminishing except on the Supreme Court. Give us sort of broad strokes about what you were talking about here.
Well, it's interesting, Coy. There's this real sort of watershed starting to happen in this country where increasingly states are calling moratoria on the death penalty. You know, that overwhelmingly the number of states who are really rethinking, not necessarily do we believe in the death penalty per se. Some states are doing that. A lot of states are saying we hate lethal injection. A lot of states are saying we hate the role that doctors play in lethal injection. So there's all sorts of problems braided into the death penalty. But overwhelmingly, the states on a state-by-state level, even that allow executions, are questioning the way it's being done. And at that exact moment, when everybody's kind of getting cold feet about the way we kill people, it seems like the Supreme Court is really digging in with the change of composition on the court. And there's at least four members of the current court who really, you know, for strong ideological reasons, sort of don't want to know what's going on the ground, you know, what's going on with those yucky lethal injections. They're just more for the death penalty than ever. And that was sort of the paradox I was trying to tease out.
And the feelings on the court, of course, safe to say it's a result of 8 years of George Bush in the White House?
Certainly. I mean, there was the big sea change on the court was the replacement of Sandra Day O'Connor with Samuel Alito. O'Connor started out her career pretty darn pro-death penalty. I mean, she was from Arizona, a death penalty state. She had no problems with it for a long time. She's very emblematic of something that tends to happen on the Supreme Court, which is that people who oversee decades and decades of executions start to get very, very wobbly on it. And we saw that most famously with Justice Harry Blackmun, who sort of famously at the end of his career said, "I shall no longer tinker with the machinery of death," you know, and just refused to impose death penalties. He didn't have that problem when he started on the court. So O'Connor was one of those people who went from being strongly pro-death penalty. And Coy, I heard her speak when I was at Stanford Law School, when I was a student there, and she gave this kind of grouchy speech about what a drag it is to be woken up at midnight by some, you know, schlub who's, you know, about to be executed, and it's a big bore. And I remember my eyes just rolling back in my head being like, come on, dude, don't be a Supreme Court justice if you don't want to be asked to, you know, stay executions at the last minute. But over the last 5-6 years, she really changed her tune, and she became very, very anxious about the racism that infects our capital system, about the quality of attorneys who defend capital defendants. And by the end of her career, she was really very, very vocal on the bench and off about her doubts about the death penalty. Sam Alito doesn't seem to be suffering from those kinds of doubts. I guess the question is, in 20 years, in 30 years, is he going to kind of come along to the place that O'Connor is at today?
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and NPR. She's live in studio, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Justice O'Connor is certainly not the swing vote. Alito is certainly not the swing vote that O'Connor became during her years in the court. Talk a little bit about the history, the legal history of the death penalty, because it was outlawed for a long time. It was legal at first, right? And then it was legal. And in the early 20th century, they just went nuts killing people left and right. And then gradually through the 20th century, it went out of favor, just as it is now, polls show.
That's right. I mean, for a brief period, the Supreme Court stopped all executions. They said that there's just no way to make this fair. What the states then did was sort of rejiggered their capital trials, how they committed, they conducted capital trials, and also rejiggered the way they execute people, so that most of the states, I think 39 of the 40 states that allow capital punishment, now use lethal injection. So they sort of cleaned it up, and then after a brief period of time, the court said, okay, we can sign off on something that looks like this. And so there was just this brief moratorium on a national level. Now what we're having happen is that states, one by one, are sort of peeling off and saying, I don't really have a problem with capital punishment, but boy, the way the system exists now is really horrifying. And so you have two states who've now imposed formal moratoria. You have one state that's that the Supreme Court, this is New York State, has said, sorry, unconstitutional. 11 states who have informally said, lethal injection isn't working, we got to figure out something else. And now 11 other states on top of that are saying, We have to very closely scrutinize what we're doing. Now, Florida is the most recent example of that. Jeb Bush, who was then the governor in December, signed off on an execution that went so horrifically awry. The guy, his name was Angel Diaz, and it took him 36 minutes to die, suffering chemical burns on his arms.
Oh, my God.
It was. I mean, there's right now in Florida, there's a commission that's examining what went wrong in Angel Diaz's death.
And this was a lethal injection?
Yeah, it was a lethal injection. And it was sort of there's sort of one set of problems with lethal injection that have to do with, you know, a big British study came out last year that said there's this three chemical cocktail that they use, and the first chemical essentially paralyzes you so that the witnesses can't see that you're in fact suffering this horrific pain. And so there's this sort of threshold question about whether, you know, you're actually being tortured. It's just not kind of showing.
And that, so they're immobilized in a lethal injection, but they're not knocked out.
Well, precisely.
They're still conscious. They just can't move.
We don't know. I mean, now the scholarship is trending that way, saying that that's exactly what happens. It's awfully hard to know because, you know, you don't see the guy thrashing on the table. And so you're left with witnesses who say different things. But certainly there is that one very, very sort of seminal British study that said that that's exactly what happens. There's another problem which has to do with the roles that doctors play in this, because these things are supposed to be supervised by physicians. And a lot of the ethical boards and the medical boards are saying, oh, my God, our job is not, you know, we take a Hippocratic oath. Our job is not to inject people. So then you either get doctors overseeing them and violating medical ethics rules, or the even more yucky thing that you have in Florida, which is that this guy wasn't a doctor. The guy who administered Angel Diaz his execution, it's not really clear what he was.
Just like the pizza delivery guy. Hey, come in here for a minute.
Kind of yucky. So we've got all sorts of problems simply with lethal injection itself.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, slate.com, and the legal correspondent for National Public Radio. She's live in studio here on Rose Hill Drive. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor at Slate, online at slate.com, and the legal correspondent for National Public Radio. She joins us live in studio here on Rose Hill Drive. We're talking about the death penalty. What doesn't work about it? There's the actual process. We've been talking about the process of actually killing somebody. Of course, it's messy, but you would think in capital punishment that it would really work. Doesn't always work. And there are a lot of problems with it. There's the whole idea of the legal process. Does that work? You know, it's no secret that poor black men are often the ones who are executed. Now, critics would say, well, that's just because they're the ones committing the crimes. But the numbers show that's not exactly true. And then you have the whole idea that the exonerations that have been going on left and right, more and more people on death row are being found to be innocent and have nothing to do with the crime that they were going to be killed for.
That's right. And I think that last thing is the thing that's really become the tipping point. That is to say that, you know, we've known for decades about, you know, the taint of racism in our capital system. And we've known for decades that capital counsel, you know, that some poor guy who's defending a death penalty, you know, defendant, and he's got 50 other cases and he's got 4 minutes to review the case and he doesn't go through the child abuse. I mean, that's the story. Inevitably, that's the story, is that, you know, you don't have great capital defense at the trial level where it really matters. That's not going to move the American public. What's really, I think, caused this sea change in American consciousness has been these exonerations. That story after story, the Innocence Project now claims, and this is Barry Scheck's project, that there have been 194 innocent exonerations since they've set up shop.
Oh,
and, you know,
man.
That 194 people have, it turns out, didn't do what was done. And, you know, it's not hard to figure out why. Crime labs make mistakes. Prosecutors are not always ethical. People perjure themselves on the stand. You know, John Grisham has written about this. I think that the American public is starting to really get a sense that when you execute someone and it was an accident, you don't get to do it over again.
Right,
and that, you know, this is not a place for slipshod work, whether it's at the level of actually executing someone in the procedure you do or the trial level, that you can't have mistakes. And that I think there's this growing sense that if we're making hundreds of mistakes. We need to reevaluate our processes.
Dahlia Lithwick is our guest. And yet you see when the election time comes around, and we'll see some of that this year here in Virginia, people run on this. I'm going to get tough on crime. I'm going to put prisoners. I'm pro-death penalty. And then, you know what? It gets votes. It gets a lot of votes. So are you saying now that it's going to start getting less votes? Because it's sort of a different thing when somebody asks you to support the death penalty. Well, you know, there's a lot of problems with it. I'm sort of mixed on it. And then it comes time to vote. You're, even if you feel that way, you're wishy-washy on it. You know there's a lot of problems with it. And we're killing innocent people. When it comes time to vote, a lot of those people still vote for somebody who stands up and says, I'm pro-death penalty.
Absolutely. And I want to be very careful. This is such a good point, Coy, to qualify that that whole sea change I'm talking about, a sort of national shift, is really belied by Virginia. Virginia is one of six states that not only isn't reexamining its death penalty processes, but is considering legislation that would broaden it, that would, in fact, you know, make more crimes eligible for the death penalty. So we are right now talking in Virginia about making accessories to or accomplices to crimes of murder liable for the death penalty.
You're kidding.
People who go after judges liable for death penalty. So we, you know, we, it's very interesting that Maryland, right up the street, is considering doing away with their death penalty altogether. And here we in Virginia are really one of the very few states, six by my count, who are talking about expanding it. So I think what you're talking about is this big sort of ideological political schism that does have to do with a sort of get tough on crime attitude on the one hand, and this sense that I'm describing on the other, that, well, we can get tough on crime, but let's not make mistakes. So I do think that there is a big, big split. It's happening in this country, and Virginia is kind of at the epicenter of it.
Yeah. Dahlia Lithwick, of course, with Slate and NPR. We've been talking about an article she wrote recently for Slate about the death penalty. Can I change gears here? I've got you for a few more minutes, and I want to change gears here and ask about, you've got to have been tracking all the legal maneuvers vis-a-vis the death of Anna Nicole. What are your thoughts on this?
Can I tell you a story?
Yes, please.
I've been covering the Supreme Court for 8 years, and never in my life did I get more press calls than I did on the day last year when Anna Nicole Smith's trial came to the United States Supreme Court. You would have, I mean, it was bigger than Bush v. Gore. It was bigger than Guantanamo policy. It was bigger than, you know, affirmative action and, you know, partial birth abortion all rolled into one. It was huge. And I realized at the time, we have kind of two legal systems in this country. We have the sort of wonky, nerdy one that I cover every day at the court. And then we have the sort of Nancy Grace law, you know, like of whatever, like little blonde kid was kidnapped this week.
Right.
And that's, you know, the legal situation. And Anna Nicole, you know, for one brief shining
moment.
She's
in the latter camp, right?
One brief shining moment. She was right in between those two worlds. She brought them together so beautifully until I realized that the only real legal story that night after, even after this big, big, big argument at the Supreme Court was, how did she look? Do you think she really loved that husband of hers, or was she just a gold digger? Which isn't to be snotty or to speak ill of the dead. I guess I've just done both of those things. But it, just watching the shenanigans in Florida this week as her body was decomposing and her, you know, all of her survivors are bickering about where she's going to be buried. And then, you know, the, as only could be fitting in this situation to have a judge who comes in who's crazier than the pack of them, who's like weeping and like says, oh, I don't have time to build foundational facts. We don't have time for facts here. And he's like calling the different attorneys, California, Texas, like he doesn't even know their names. It was, I mean, in some ways it was just a spectacle. In some ways it was such a sort of sick and perfect coda to this life of hers, you know, this legal life of hers. And so, you know, I the one thing that's sort of a crime about it is that, you know, the other little trial that was happening in Texas this week was this competency hearing for Jose Padilla, you know, the last enemy combatant that we're holding in the United States, who is an American citizen who was thrown into a Navy brig and essentially tortured for years. And they're trying to determine if, like, we've made him so crazy that he can't stand trial. But we're all so transfixed by Anna Nicole Smith that we can't even watch, you know, what I think is the single most important trial that is going to go on in this country this year, which is, you know, this poor guy was tortured and tortured and tortured, and now he's too crazy to defend himself.
And he's an American citizen.
And he's a U.S. citizen.
Now, why is this case important? Tell us.
Well, because this was the first time that the Bush administration grabbed someone who was a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil. They picked him up at O'Hare Airport, and they said, you're an enemy combatant. And so none of the traditional rules of habeas corpus or fair trials, right to counsel, apply to you. They just chucked him in the brig. And, you know, whenever we talk about what's happening, you know, to enemy detainees, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq or Guantanamo, we sort of think to ourselves, oh, yeah, but that's those guys. But this wasn't.
They're not Americans.
Those guys. This is one of us. And I think, you know, we should all be riveted by this proceeding. And we should all really see this as a sort of benchmark of what's happened to civil liberties in this country. I mean, this has nothing to do with whether, you know, he started off being the radiological bomber. And then they say, well, he's not that. He's just an apartment bomber. And now the charges have been downgraded to he's just kind of a terrorist guy. But, you know.
Did they have anything really on him?
Oh, what they've got on him is pretty scary. It's a couple of phone calls that he made to some of his compatriots sort of bragging about, you know, jihad and very vague plots. But, I mean, compared to what, you know, when John Ashcroft first got up and boasted that we had, you know, someone who was going to set off radiological bombs in the United States and that we, you know, the boasting that accompanied this initial, you know, seizure of this man and then the treatment or the lack of legal, you know, any sort of legal recourse that he had for years is so shocking. And the idea that we're not even interested or focused on, you know, what is happening at his trial right now because we're bickering over Anna Nicole Smith's decomposing body is heartbreaking.
Or all the, we were talking earlier about all the thousands of kids who've died in Iraq, you know, that these young people who volunteered to serve America, sent to Iraq, all on lies, and yet they're dying every day. And yet they'll be lucky to make a little blurb in their hometown paper. You know, nothing close to what Anna Nicole is getting. It's really interesting. When does the Jose Padilla trial start?
Well, right now they're going through a competency hearing. And starting on Monday, we're going to have something that is unprecedented in American trials, which is the judge has demanded that the captors who are in the Navy brig who abused him come forth and testify. So we're going to get a lot of details starting Monday that the administration has really kept from us about how people who are labeled enemy combatants are treated. And that will go on until the judge determines whether or not he can, in fact, stand trial. If she decides he is not too crazy to defend himself and to stand trial, that trial starts mid-April.
So the headlines next week are going to be, there's a chance they're going to be similar to that week of Abu Ghraib, the weeks of Abu Ghraib, when we talked about the mistreatment of these people over there, but now we're talking about the torture of an American citizen.
Or what's probably comes right up to the line of torture, but certainly, you know, isolation and extreme solitary confinement. He had headphones on so that he could never hear anything, you know, and sleep deprivation. I mean, there's the sort of paradox here is that he was treated that way so that he would break and confess. And now that he's broken, for the administration to say, oh, we didn't actually break him, it's just so shocking.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate Magazine, online at slate.com, and the legal correspondent for National Public Radio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Always a pleasure. Have a good weekend.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.